What is up, you Dutchman's beards? Welcome to No Holds Barred, the Shakespeare podcast Shakespeare would have listened to. I'm Dan Bollier.
And I'm Kevin Condardo. We are back with this month's So You're Going to See Shakespeare episode, where the goal of the idea of the episode is to give you something to listen to in transit to a Shakespearean production so that we can prepare you to be the best little audience members that you can be.
An audio version of the dramaturgical notes, if you will.
So, hopefully you'll enjoy this episode as you head out to see Twelfth Night,
or what you will. Here we go.
The first thing we need to cover before we get into this episode is a quick synopsis of the play, so at least you know the story. Dan, take it away.
So we start in the court of the Duke Orsino, who is desperately in love with the Countess Olivia. Sadly for Orsino, Olivia's brother has died, and she has announced that she will be in mourning and unable to receive guests for the next 7 years. Orsino is totally into this, imagining how much she'd love a husband if she could love a brother that much.
Out of the water at a nearby beach comes Viola and a ship's captain, apparently the only two survivors of a shipwreck. Viola fears that her brother, who was on the ship with her, has drowned. The captain tells her the area that she has landed in probably isn't a great spot for a young woman on her own, so Viola decides naturally to disguise herself as a young gentleman named Cesario and head off to Orsino's court to see if she can get a job working for him. When she arrives there, Orsino agrees to take him/her on and makes Cesario's first assignment to go to the mourning Olivia to woo on his behalf.
At Olivia's, her drunk uncle, Sir Toby Belch, is taking advantage of her hospitality alongside his foppish, wealthy friend, Sir Andrew Aguecheek. Andrew is also trying, unsuccessfully, to woo Olivia, and Toby convinces him to keep trying and keep paying for Toby's tab. In the same court, Feste, the jester, returns and escapes chastisement from his Lady Olivia with some wit, which is promptly shit upon by Malvolio, the stalwart steward. No one likes Malvolio, who also happens to be in love with Olivia, for what it's worth.
Viola Cesario gains admittance to meet with Olivia and woos on Orsino's behalf, and perhaps is a little too successful, as Olivia instantly falls in love with Cesario. Viola realizes this is a problem, especially considering, terribly inconveniently, that Viola has fallen in love with Orsino.
Meanwhile, on a different beach, because this is a beach town, Viola's twin brother Sebastian, who actually did not drown in the shipwreck, washes up on shore with his friend Antonio. Sebastian heads towards Orsino's court and tells Antonio to stay behind as he is wanted in these territories for piracy and other things. But Antonio just cares too much for Sebastian and secretly follows at great risk to himself.
Back at the ranch, Sir Toby, Sir Andrew, Feste, and Mariah come back from a night of getting hammered and make a huge racket on Olivia's front lawn, which draws Malvolio out to chastise them for being a bunch of a**s. In response, the group decides to ruin Malvolio's life by making him think Olivia's in love with him. Their plan starts with having Mariah write a letter to a letter in Olivia's penmanship and pretending to be from her, and leaving it in a place where they know Malvolio will find it. And, of course, when he does find it, he falls for it hook, line, and sinker, particularly the part of the letter where, quote-unquote, Olivia says she wishes Malvolio would wear yellow stockings much more often.
A short while afterwards, Malvolio arrives at Olivia's chambers in yellow stockings and following all of the terms outlined in Mariah's fake letter, which just happens to have instructed him to do a bunch of stuff Olivia actually hates, culminating in Malvolio telling off Sir Toby in Olivia's presence. Shortly afterwards, Andrew issues a challenge to Viola / Cesario because he feels he's been cut in line in courting Olivia, except Andrew has no interest in actually dueling. Viola, as it turns out, also has no interest in dueling. The two are as ready as they'll ever be to square off when Antonio arrives, sees who he thinks is Sebastian about to fight to the death, and jumps in to kill Sir Andrew. Sir Toby, seeing things escalate further than he had anticipated, jumps to Andrew's defense and arrests Antonio. Antonio asks Cesario for help, thinking him to be Sebastian. Viola slash Cesario can't help, but takes this as a sign that Sebastian might have survived the shipwreck after all.
Everybody's still with us? Okay, great. Toby and Andrew now have the quote-unquote mad Malvolio locked up and decide to dress Feste up as a local curate to try and mock exorcise whatever demons have entered him. Malvolio insists he has not gone mad, but Feste isn't having it and kind of hazes him in a pretty ugly and unpleasant way.
Sebastian arrives nearby Olivia's court, and Olivia finds him, thinking him to be Cesario. The key difference now is that whereas Cesario rebuffed her advances, Sebastian is very into them. He's not really sure why a countess is throwing herself at him, but he's not in a position to ask questions and decides to marry her.
Mm-hmm. So in the final scene, all of the characters arrive at the same place to hash out their differences. First, Antonio arrives in handcuffs and asks Cesario again to help him out in the same way Antonio helped out Sebastian when he saved him from the shipwreck. Cesario has no idea what he's talking about. Immediately following, Olivia announces to everyone that she has married Cesario. Orsino, thinking Cesario has stabbed him in the back, is outraged that Cesario could do that to him. Cesario, being Viola and not Sebastian, and being in love with Orsino, has no idea what Olivia is talking about. Just then Andrew comes in bleeding and says Cesario smacked him around. Cesario, unsurprisingly, has no idea what anyone is talking about. At this point, Sebastian enters and everything finally makes sense to everyone because they realize, hey, they're twins and this is the fifth act of a Shakespeare comedy. Cesario reveals himself to be a female named Viola and proclaims her love for Orsino, who is unsurprisingly totally into it. In the last sequence, Malvolio comes in, tells everyone he knows what they did to them, and he'll be revenged on the whole pack of them, which naturally prompts everyone to go off and get married. And that is Twelfth Night.
Or what you will.
Now that you know what you'll be watching, we're going to take a few minutes to talk about where Twelfth Night, or what you will, falls in Shakespeare's personal timeline and what was happening in the world when it was written. Daniel.
Yes. So the first recorded or first known performance happened February 2nd, 1602, at Middle Temple Hall, which is a historic central London venue. It is what's interesting about this, I think, is that we're looking at an indoor performance on Candlemas, which would have been or Twelfth Night, mm-hmm. the actual holiday, which falls 12 days. Well, there's some debate. It falls 12 days after Christmas.
Right. It's the 12th night of Christmas, as it were, which
right.
is January 6th.
Right. The Epiphany, the idea of when the wise men arrived at the nativity of Christ. Mm-hmm. So what's interesting in terms of some religious background on the holiday itself, Twelfth Night is a topsy-turvy holiday. It's when all the roles in religion were turned on their head. Mm-hmm. So you'd have the priests would take the lower status role and the servants would become the higher status, mm-hmm. which is something that's reflected in the play. Whether or not this was actually was named because it was performed on Twelfth Night or on a religious holiday is interesting, but it's more about, I think, the theme.
Right.
Above the upside down.
Right. It's kind of an echo, I think, the closest contemporary to the kind of allowed chaos in a religious capacity is probably Mardi Gras.
Exactly.
Right? Where it's like the night before we're about to kick off, Ash Wednesday, so let's get rowdy. Not exactly the same, but that type of license.
100%. And New Orleans actually is one of the centers for the Twelfth Night celebration still happening.
Huh.
So that there's... That. Yeah, of course.
So book your tickets now. The year before, in 1601, there was a visitor to the Queen Elizabeth's court that Shakespeare almost definitely met, an Italian duke named Don Virginio Orsini, who is likely an influence for Orsino and the rest of the Italianate references in this play. Another Italian influence is that in 1595, an Italian immigrant named Vincenzo Saviolo wrote a fencing manual aimed to teach the English how to behave. This is likely why Toby refers to dueling by the duello, because of this book that people would have been aware of about dueling.
That's interesting.
That the Italians were super good at.
Right. That's really interesting. I did not know that. Something that's pretty cool about Twelfth Night. A year before, almost a year to the date before the first performance at Middle Temple was Essex's Revolt, which Essex led against the Queen, which was squashed almost instantly.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really...
Shut out.
It's just shut out. Just I thought we had it, didn't have it.
Nope.
But it's interesting to think that there was this major upheaval, and Essex is, of course, so close to the Queen.
Mm-hmm.
And we're nearing... This is towards the end of the Queen's life.
Yes. That's the other note, the last note that I have.
Oh,
yeah.
Spoilers.
That this is one of the last Elizabethan plays.
Right.
Before we get into James. So.
So it's interesting to think about this upheaval and this idea of chaos.
Mm-hmm. And the uncertainty that they may have been feeling as we move towards the end of Elizabeth with no direct heirs.
Right.
Like, oh boy.
Whoop. This is all just misrule. Mm-hmm. And the Lord of Misrule is another key figure in the Twelfth Night celebration, of the person who's kind of leading all of this. I don't know. It's like a roller coaster that doesn't have a track. You know, it's just it's just going.
Yeah.
So that's there you go. Going on.
That's a little bit of the history of what was going on when Shakespeare wrote this play. In this segment, we will identify what we consider to be the most prominent theme in the play and particular places where you may see it come up. Dan has chosen his three favorites.
Yes.
And I'm going to pick mine of those three for us to dig in on. Daniel.
Yes.
Who are our finalists?
Well, the finalists for Miss Best Theme in Twelfth Night, or what you will, Gender, Desire, and Disguise. Gender, Desire, and Disguise.
I think let's go with gender.
Great.
Let's go with gender.
I love it.
So, you know, the... It's all over this play, obviously, between Cesario in a pants role.
Yep.
You know, we have our theory, gender in terms of statuses and interpersonal roles, being, you know, all of the men in this play who are in love with Olivia for all of their various reasons.
Yep.
Olivia being a female in the position of highest power in this play, right? Although I guess...
Well, her and the Duke, yeah.
Yeah, because I guess Orsino, the Duke outweighs a Countess.
I'm not 100% clear on that, but she's certainly in a position of power in her house.
Yes,
and she's running it quite well.
Yeah. Right, well, and she's she carries herself with more status than Orsino does anyway, since he just lays on his back and listens to emo rock all day. So there's that struggle. There's also... you know, I mean, a theory that you and I have about, I guess that's not gender, that's more sexuality, but Antonio.
Yeah.
And the likelihood of Antonio's love for Sebastian being more than a fraternal love.
Right.
But that's not really this.
Right.
Yeah, so those, I guess those would be my big three tickets. Why did this make the list for you?
The list. So I think in terms of gender structure, it's always interesting with the pants roles. And when we say pants roles, if you're not familiar, just the female characters who don the mask of a male character and what that enables them to do.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting, I think, in terms of gender here is that Viola takes on Cesario, who is a male, but is also of a far lower status
than Viola is.
Mm-hmm. And she has to deal with that. That's always something in performance that I struggle with, is the Violas who do well with being like, well, I'm still Viola. Like, at my essence, I'm royalty. And they carry that sort of air of, I guess it's just a stature or demeanor that they bring to Cesario.
Weight. Yeah.
Whereas, like, I'm not just a servant. And that's, I think, ultimately what Olivia is attracted to.
Right.
Is this sense of, I've never met a servant who carries himself so well. Well, it's because... It's Viola.
Right, exactly.
Not just
right, because it's not schlub. Just a servant. Yeah.
Right. Is schlub a word?
Schlub, yeah, sure, yeah.
Cool.
It checks out.
Yeah, it works.
I'll get my lexicon. We'll double check.
Other gender roles in the... I think there's something interesting about... You look at Orsino's court, which is heavily male.
Mm-hmm.
To the point that, I mean, it's so carnal.
Okay.
He is when you meet him, he's all about hunting and
the
appetite
and
devouring. And Olivia's court is more nuanced. Even though Toby and Andrew are bags.
Right.
They're still talking about arts and culture. Like, it's a different structure in terms of, like, just their houses.
Yeah.
And I think there's something in terms of, maybe not in terms of 2016 gender roles, but when this was being written, it's really interesting to think about the idea of a masculine house versus a feminine house.
Yeah.
And that it's not just their physical genders, but what the environments that they live in.
Right, and how they carry themselves.
Yeah, and how people can move, how some people can flourish in both, and some just can't.
Right, like Feste has no problem switching back and forth.
No problem.
Malvolio would probably be better at Orsino's court.
I don't know. I feel like they would eat him alive. They'd be like,
yeah, maybe.
You know, he's of a different era.
Yeah.
That they'd be like, no, we brought in a deer. We're going to skin it. He'd be like,
I'm going to go.
I'm going to go now.
I'm a vegetarian. Well, anyways, that is Gender. Keep an eye out for it when you go off to see Twelfth Night. In this section of the show, we choose which non-title characters we would most want to play in this piece and explain why in 2 minutes or less. Dan won the coin flip before the show and has elected to go first.
Yes.
So here we go, Daniel.
Wonderful. So since I can't play the 12th night.
Oh my God, we're still doing this.
Yeah, of course. I can't play the 11th night, the 10th night, any of those nights. There's a whole court of nights. All of those are off the board. I can't play Will, what you will. I will play Feste.
I'm shocked.
As I'm just displayed by robust wit in setting that up.
I don't think robust means what you think it means, if you're going to use it like that.
Feste is one of those characters. I mean, this is, we just joked about it, but yeah, we know who we're playing in this. Like, this is, Feste is like, yep. If I can get a Feste tattoo and just become Feste, I would do that.
Is Feste your favorite character? Would Feste be your first choice of all?
It's up there. It's in the top three.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd love his dexterity in the show. I just love the idea that he's like, hey, everybody, you all suck. Like, here's my point. Also, I'm an idiot and I'm a fool, so feel free to ignore me because I don't care. Because
I don't care.
But you might want to take a look at that.
Yeah.
Which I love his style. I like the wordplay. This is probably an Armin role, Robert Armin. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be one of Shakespeare's wittier fools. You know, that whole distinction between clown and fool. This is a fool.
Mm-hmm.
And he also has the speech where he talks about, where he basically prays to the god of fooling. To be like, please help me out today. I love that. Like, I do that every morning.
Into good fooling.
Yeah. You know, it's like, yep, this is my role.
Yeah.
I'll try.
That's such a great line too, where it's like, my whole existence is being funny. And if I'm not funny and insightful enough, I'm going to die. So please.
I need this one. I kind of messed up. Mariah's super pissed.
Yeah.
Olivia's going to be even more pissed. How do I get out of this? I know. Comedy.
Here we go. Waka waka. For me, similarly, since we know who we're going to play, I would want to play Malvolio, who feel like is, I know, can you believe it? As a stead professional who's just trying to do his goddamn job. In this spring break environment that's falling apart, you know, I feel like, you know, and granted, Malvolio is also not a great dude for a number of reasons, just a smug, unbearable, person who I, you know, that would be a reach for me to get to, but I feel like I have the chops to find that. I also, you know, this is the same thing. It's in the long line of antagonists who I love so much that I feel like you can, you know, there's no, you would never play anyone as a bad guy.
Right.
Just like, why does he do that? Because he's a bad guy.
Right.
It's like, no, Malvolio is justified in all the things, in his life view, he is acting the way that people should act. And it's really not so much to ask that when you come home at 4 a.m, you don't just go on the front lawn and just start like throwing shit around.
Right.
Like, just go to bed. We live in a castle. Like, go down to the rec room and fire up the GameCube and do whatever you want, but not on the front lawn. I mean, it's, you know, it's 1602.
Right, of course. N64.
Right. And then also, you know, it's the same. There are a couple of lines in this play that can be throwaway lines or can be like really show stealing lines.
Yeah.
And I'll be revenged on the whole pack of you is such a good line.
It's a great line.
That can really be colored in multiple ways depending on who your Malvolio is. Like, if that's a man of, if that's a man of a false status being broken, it can be sad. It can be scary, depending on if he's dangerous. Right. Like, it can be a lot of things.
Right.
And it's one of the better exit lines, I would think, for a character who doesn't die, who actually gets to, like, live.
There are total, I mean, there are complete productions that are based on that line.
Yeah.
Like, it colors the whole, what does that mean? Yeah. Oh, shoot.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. So there you go. Those are the roles we would play. Let us know who how they are in the production that you are going out to see.
Probably not as good as we would do. But
naturally. This is the section of the show where we pull our favorite phrase from the play and talk through it so that you can nod smugly and knowingly when you hear it in performance. The line we chose from Twelfth Night is, "Was not this love indeed?" from Act 2, Scene 4. Let's hear the phrase in context. "Once more, Cesario, get thee to yon same sovereign cruelty. Tell her my love, more noble than the world, prizes not quantity of dirty lands. The parts that fortune hath bestowed upon her, tell her, I hold as giddily as fortune. But 'tis that miracle and queen of gems that nature pranks her in attracts my soul."
"But if she cannot love you, sir?"
"I cannot be so answered."
"Sooth, but you must. Say that some lady, as perhaps there is, hath for your love as great a pang of heart as you have for Olivia. You cannot love her. You tell her so. Must she not then be answered?"
"There is no woman's sides can bide the beating of so strong a passion as love doth give my heart. No woman's heart so big to hold so much. They lack retention. Alas, their love may be called appetite. No motion of the liver, but the palate that suffers surfeit, cloyment, and revolt. But mine is all hungry as the sea, and can digest as much. Make no compare between that love a woman can bear me, and that I, O Olivia."
"Aye, but I know."
"What dost thou know?"
"Too well what love women to men may owe. In faith, they are as true of heart as we. My father had a daughter loved a man, as it might be, perhaps, were I a woman, I should your lordship."
"And what's her history?"
"A blank, my lord. She never told her love, but let concealment, like a worm in the bud, feed on her damask cheek. She pined in thought, and with a green and yellow melancholy, she sat like patience on a monument, smiling at grief. Was not this love indeed? We men may say more, swear more, but indeed our shows are more than will, for still we prove much in our vows, but little in our love."
"But died thy sister of her love, my boy?"
"I am all the daughters of my father's house, and all the brothers, too, and yet I know not. Sir, shall I to this lady?"
There you go. That is, "Was not this love indeed?" from Act 2, Scene 4 of Twelfth Night.
Misty up in here.
Right. Dan, you want to give us a little context on this?
Absolutely. So we are back at Duke Orsino's court. Olivia has rejected the first advance, and basically Cesario, or Viola, has seen Olivia and now knows what she's up against, and also is falling more and more in love with Orsino. And they're having this private moment where Orsino's like, "You have to go get her for me." And she's like, "I really don't want to." And he's like, "But you have to." And she's like, "But she doesn't love you. She doesn't love you. You have to accept that." He's like, "I don't have to accept that." Mm-hmm. And then basically, Viola, this is a moment, crack in the armor, I think we've talked about before. This is the crack where Viola almost loses it and comes out and says, I love you."
Right, right, exactly.
Like, but basically doesn't. Mm-hmm. And that's her point.
Yeah.
Is that she's like, my father had this daughter and it's me, but I can't tell you that, but it's me, who just did whatever the person that she loved asked her to, and it was the worst, and it hurt, but she did it. Isn't that what love really is?
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the line.
Yeah, and I mean, the other thing, you know, this was a much longer cut than we usually do for these, but it's because this whole scene is so good.
It's so good.
There's so many good things in here, but you know, we usually joke that this is the part where you reach over into your date's lap and you take their hand and you really, like, connect on this line, "Was not this love indeed?" Because, you know, we've all been there.
Of course.
These pangs of love. Like, right. What's the other line she has about virtue on a monument? Like, patience on a monument.
Patience on a monument. Yeah. Smiling at grief.
We've all been there. Yikes.
Right. And that's a beautiful paradox of the smiling at grief, of just saying, yes. I mean, as Red Sox fans, we know this. Well, we knew this all too well prior to winning 3 and...
But who's counting?
I mean, but you know, that sense of like, ah, oh, yeah, there they go. Mm-hmm. They just blew it. And that hurts so good.
Right? I feel alive.
I feel.
It's also interesting in this scene that, I mean, the part that Orsino has before this, where he's like, I love so much that a woman has no idea.
Right.
A woman is not physically able to love as much as I love right now.
And you just see Viola sitting there being like seriously?
Dying. Yeah. And also, right. I mean, when you see it in production, all of the ladies in the house do not say yeah. They say nay to this.
Right.
And I think it's actually a chance that Orsino has to grow a little bit, like, in an instant.
Yeah.
Based on this speech that Viola has that, you know, has to lay the seed for Orsino. This is probably where Orsino feels for the first time a little bit of like, I feel some weird feelings towards this boy.
Absolutely.
That I'm not really clear on.
Yep.
I'm going to sort those out later. But for now, head over to Olivia and figure that out.
There was a wonderful moment in the Globe production that came over to Broadway where Orsino just held Viola after I'm All the Daughters in My Father's House and realizing on the line and all the brothers too, remember that she thinks her brother's dead.
Right.
So in that moment, Viola realized I'm the only person alive and like broke down. It was gorgeous.
Yeah.
And that's when you just drive the scene, that's possible. You can get to that moment of like, oh my God.
Yeah.
That is love. And then the moment of connection wasn't sexual. It was just two humans being like, I've got you.
Right.
Which was, it was a beautiful moment.
Yeah. So there you go. Keep an ear out for it when you go to see this in production. Was not this love indeed? In this last segment of the show, we will highlight the biggest practical challenge to the director in this play and share a few ideas on how it has been solved in the past. For Twelfth Night, I think the biggest challenge is the line, one face, one voice, one habit, and two persons in Act 5, Scene 1. Dan, you want to give us a little context on what that is?
Sure. This is when Orsino, well, everyone sees Sebastian and Viola together for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we're really talking about here, the challenge isn't the line, is how do you handle the twins?
Right.
Right.
This is the same problem that you're going to run into in either this or Comedy of Errors when you're trying to cast for twins, that, you know, especially at least in Comedy of Errors, the two sets of twins are characters of generally the same scope.
Sure.
You know, in this play, Viola is such a humongous part and Sebastian's not as large of a part.
Right.
And so the director has to make a choice.
Yeah.
Whether they are going to cast people who look exactly correct and Sebastian, basically if you cast Viola and then you find someone who looks like your Viola,
right,
and you just hope they can read,
right,
or you cast a good Sebastian, who you cast the best Sebastian with no connection to Viola and then figure it out
and
from
then
there.
Everyone in the play is stupid.
Exactly. Like, right. Right. And I feel like I do hate that when they look like I've seen productions where they make no effort.
Right.
They're just like, they could be siblings.
Right.
But like Sebastian's 6 inches taller.
Right.
Like not wearing the same thing. Like not, there's no connection. And then in that last scene, they're like, oh,
right,
I got you confused. It's like, they don't even look the same.
Right.
They have different color hair. Like you're insulting my intelligence with this. So I've seen that too many times. And quite frankly, it's unacceptable.
Sure. Of course. I think that's part of why I love Feste, is that he sees right through the twins and is like, I know who you are.
Mm-hmm.
So that does give some justification for them being a little different.
Yeah.
And it just tells you that the people in the play don't notice the things around them, which is...
It works.
It works.
Yeah.
This is a play about people who are wasting time.
Right.
And just like, I'm the most important person in my world, is pretty much the through line for a lot of these characters in this play.
You could justify that for pretty much everyone in this play other than Feste, that they could internally come up with a reason why they don't notice.
Right. And he's angry about it, which I like. But I do think it was, again, to talk about that production at the Globe, which they brought over to Broadway, mm-hmm. they did a great job of, you never saw them together. And you saw them seconds apart mm-hmm. all the time. And they looked identical. Mm-hmm. And it was awesome. Because mm-hmm. when they finally met, you're like, yes!
Yeah.
Yes, I've been waiting.
Yeah. I know in the Shakespeare in the Park production from about... maybe 7-8 years ago,
yeah,
they had Sebastian was about 6 to 9 inches taller, like a much bigger dude, but proportionally looked the same, and they dressed them exactly the same, and they had exactly the same hair and basically the same skin tone. But since you didn't see them on stage together, it was, and because it's Shakespeare, it's a giant room, you know, it's right. an 1800 seat theater,
yeah.
And on a giant set outside. So, you didn't have... And the set was constructed in such a way that you didn't really have the markers.
Okay.
They looked the same. But then there was a great moment in the scene. What it led to was in the scene where Olivia says to Sebastian, we're getting married, or the first time they connect, after she's been, like, trying to paw Viola the whole show,
yeah.
she goes to grab, like, she puts her hands on his chest, and it's, like, 6 inches higher and significantly broader, and she's like, whoa! So, like, she gets it, and she is not asking questions. She's like, I like this version. I'll take yep. two, please.
Upgrade. But, yeah. I think the problem, another challenge here, if you're listening, if you're working the marketing department of any theater, mm-hmm. please stop putting out pictures of the twins together. Like, that's that's not a good poster.
No.
It spoils the show.
Right. And they never look like twins on the poster.
Right.
Like, you're showing your hand in a way that, like, it's like a magician being like, here's my last trick.
Right. Here's how this one works.
Right. Like, it's like you're killing us with this, because right. you're never going to cast people unless you have actual twins.
Right.
Like, don't do that thing.
Even still, don't.
Yeah.
Because if you have actual twins, it still isn't fun to see them together
yeah.
until Act 5.
Right.
That's the farcical fun of this comedy.
Yeah. So there you go. That's our challenge. When you go out to see Twelfth Night, let us know how they handle it and how angry we should be at them.
Yeah. I'll go with angry. Let's go with angry.
That's kind of our it's kind of our default.
Cool.
All right, folks, that's going to do it for this episode. If you found this helpful, please subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes so we can keep bringing Shakespeare to your headphones on a weekly basis. If you have questions or comments or would like to get back to us, you can email us at noholdsbarredpodcast@gmail.com. You can help us out on our Patreon at patreon.com/noholdsbarred. You can tweet us at noholdsbarredcast, or you can Facebook us at facebook.com/noholdsbarredcast. So until next time, I'm Kevin Condardo.
And I'm Dan Boyer.
But that's all one. Our play is done.
And we'll strive to please you every day.
Adieu, adieu, adieu. Adieu, 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 adieu.